On the Bookshelf with your host, Dave Doug Kirby.
When I was in college, I remember hearing about the Cambodian genocide, about the Khmer Rouge taking over the country, and we heard terrible reports, people being executed for wearing glasses because they were seen as part of the intelligentsia and therefore dangerous to the Khmer Rouge. Of course, there was the movie The Killing Field that came out that told the story, but what I have for you today is something even more personal because it is told by the son of someone who survived this when he was a teenager. We are delighted to welcome to On the Bookshelf James Tang, who is the author, along with his father, May Bunsing Tang, of Under the Naga Tail, a true story of survival, bravery, and escape from the Cambodian regime. From Greenleaf Book Group, James, thank you so very much. My gratitude to your father, too, for telling the story, which had to have been pretty horrific for him to say and pretty horrific for you to have to hear.
Thank you for having me. Yeah, it is an honor as well. And that is a big sentiment to my father. It has been a very long journey for my father, who has wanted to tell this story for over four decades since he came to this country. He survived this genocide, which was known in only in the years after 1980s of what transpired. And it was dubbed the Killing Fields, or sometimes the Second Holocaust.
Yeah.
And so there's that main story there, which I've been trying to correct for a youth and a younger generation who have really not much knowledge of the time period of the Cold War, particularly the Vietnam War era. And then there's also the second bit where not only my father survived the genocide and a concentration camp within the genocide, he also survived a refugee crisis that took place in the years preceding afterwards.
Yeah.
Which is actually a story that is not not told at all. And there were so many things that took place. There were so many people of compassion trying to help, but there's also much more danger that faced my father. Compared, he would say, even worse than what he faced during this genocide in Cambodia. So that's kind of where this story, Under Naga Tail, picks up and tries to help tell a story that needs to be told, but even reveal a new one that hasn't been really shared.
I must admit that I had not heard and not realized it until I've read your book about what happened in Thailand, that at first, when they got to Thailand after an arduous and dangerous travail, things seemed good, but their story wasn't over. By the way, James Tang is the founder of the Pravihir Foundation, a nonprofit that advocates for preserving the history of refugee rescue in Cambodia and the greater French Indochina region in the 1970s. And his dad was a survivor of the Khmer Rouge genocide in Cambodia. And that's not overstating thing. It wasn't the population diminished by about 30% during the genocide?
That is the current estimation. Some think that there's a big range, and that's probably the more conservative one as to when Cambodia, before this genocide, Cambodia in the 1960s was considered an impeccable country. The French had, it was always their favorite destination, one of their favorite overseas, and they used to call Cambodia or Phnom Penh the capital, Little Paris, Petit Paris. And they would dub the Cambodia as their pearl of the Orient in comparison to like how the British saw Hong Kong.
Right.
So it had a very strong attention, and Cambodia was quite modern. My father grew up watching movies and did all the same things, played soccer, and he had basketball, the same toys kind of grew up in the 50s and 60s. That changed very quickly, where this very modern country was pretty much taken over by extreme factions of radical communists, the leader being Pol Pot. And his vision when he took over the country, this is and why this happens is sort of the rupturing of the Vietnam War over into Cambodia. And his vision is to instate the most ideal and pure form of communism in Cambodia. And his idea was we need to go back to the roots of our country, which is agriculture. This turned into a very terrible political experiment. It created lots of paranoia amongst the elites or the leadership in the Khmer Rouge. They began to kill immediately, as you have mentioned at the beginning, intellectuals, like anyone who wore glasses, doctors, teachers, lawyers, businessmen, artisans, artists, musicians, all of it, because they said our pride of our country is going back to our roots, which is to be farmers. That was the perfect citizen and the perfect soldier of this new country. And so this turned into a genocide, and then there was a new term that academics created called to describe what particularly happened in Cambodia, because they went from killing these specific types of people, and then it grew worse into and deteriorated worse into killing basically everyone.
Yeah.
Mass murder on large scale. And the term that was created was called autogenocide, since it was killing your own citizens just for the sake of it. And that's how very just far Cambodia had fallen. So, and then that leads to the next part, which is this only ended, ironically, because the Vietnamese, which had just won their war, the Vietnam War, had come in and liberated, in some ways, conquered Cambodia, and were able to defeat and battle the Khmer Rouge and chase them out. And so that was the only way the terrible genocide had ended there.
It seemed at some point, as I was reading through the book and reading, every day brought a new terror, every day brought a new threat, every day brought a new death. It's amazing that as many people survived as they did, because it seems like, from an outsider analyzing this, it seemed like if you took a bunch of teenage boys who really had no idea about the reality of life and gave them weapons and said, you are now in charge, whatever you come up with is the right thing because you are empowered by the Khmer Rouge to be the new leaders of our country, and everybody must share everything equally. And it was the worst parts of the Great Leap Forward in China, and the 5-year plan in the Soviet Union when it was new. The same sort of insanity goes on. People who have no idea how to farm are put in charge of making other people farm, and the ones who know how to farm are being killed. And your grandfather was someone who was knowledgeable about how to do some of these things. And instead of saying, you be in charge, they just turned him, like everybody else, into a pack animal. It's the most ridiculous way of running anything that could ever be imagined. And yet these guys thought that they were doing the exact right thing that needed to be done, and just randomly slaughtering people as they went.
Yeah, and that is the... That is the most interesting part of this, is that the leadership, Pol Pot and all of his men beneath him, thought they were doing what was right. They were such idealists. And they were very much passionate about the idea that Cambodia can become a First Nation country again through this experiment. And I think you can see that in the way they sort of conducted themselves. It's a very interesting part of history where they also, what's not well known is that for 5 years, Cambodia was basically shut out when the Khmer Rouge took over.
Yeah.
So for 5 years, they had no contact with the outside world, and they were able to conduct all of this 5-year plan in total secrecy. It's very much similar like what North Korea does today, but even more so at that level. So the world back then did not know what was happening in Cambodia. It was quote unquote hermetically sealed. And certain people who were sympathetic to the Khmer Rouge and what they were doing tried to go in and report what was happening. And obviously it was often things that were curated. And then some people weren't able to make it out. But we only truly knew, like, what actually took place when the Vietnamese came through and liberated the country. And that happened in 1979. And then the stories of all these people who survived and the tremendous willpower that it took for them to survive, the losses that it took, only then, when the borders started open, then the stories started to come out. And it just shook a lot of people, what was being reported.
Yeah.
And a lot of people would say, you can't trust these refugees and what they're saying. This is unbelievable. There's no truth to it. They're just making up stuff. They're imaginative. They just hate their own old country, and that's why they're saying these things. But the problem is more and more people come out and start saying these things, and then you actually go into Cambodia, these reporters, and you can witness all the mass graves that took place there.
It is really...
And this shock...
Yeah,
yeah. I'll have to say it shocked the world because Cambodia was the idyllic tourist country.
Yeah,
and they saw Cambodians as being the kindest and fairest and the most gentle-hearted people, and they could not imagine that this would transpire.
It reminds me of what I've read of how toward the end of World War II, when word began to get out about the Nazi camps, and people who might survive or somehow manage to get back to civilization and are telling these stories, and people in the United States couldn't believe it. They said, oh, no, come on. You're just exaggerating this to make sure that we got involved in the war and so forth. And then when we started liberating the camps, we realized, oh, my gosh, it's so much worse than we could ever have thought. That's the way it was real journalists finally got to go into Cambodia and found mounds of human skulls and bodies that had been torn apart by animals out in the jungles and people who were sort of buried but parts of bones sticking up because they'd only been buried in a couple of inches because the people who were being forced to bury them were so emaciated. Hearing about your grandfather, hearing about your dad, and how they managed to survive on practically no food and practically no water for day after day after day, living in filth and not even being able to remember when's the last time you had any water to wash in or anything like that. These kind of things are so jarring to the modern sensitivity and modern realization that this happened less than 50 years ago, and truly the irony was that the North Vietnamese, after defeating the South Vietnamese and sending them off to re-education camps, then invaded Cambodia and rescued the victims of the Khmer Rouge. Even the Vietnamese communists thought these guys are crazy, and they really were had wildly idealistic and no realistic thinking whatsoever, right?
Yeah, it's amazing how our enemy during World War, Vietnam War, were the ones who came and rescued Cambodia. Yeah. I always find that fact. There are some diplomats and State Department workers who even go as far to say that the Vietnamese deserved the Nobel Peace Prize for what they did back then.
But this is where we can get to the point of Thailand. It took how long for your dad and much of his family to finally get to the border and get into Thailand? And Cambodia is not a large country. You could probably drive across it in a couple of hours. For it to take this long is an indication of just how they were being starved to death, dehydrated, beaten, tortured, forced to act as pack animals, carrying insanely large loads It's a wonder it didn't break their bones, because they didn't have any meat on their bones hardly at that point, and yet they managed to survive. And they finally get to the Thai border, and they then are taken in by Thailand, and it looks like their nightmare is over, but it's just put on pause, isn't it?
Yeah, this seems like a new beginning for them. They are, like my father, and has made the decision to leave Cambodia. He is very concerned about his future. He sees that wars keep happening. He sees the Vietnamese there. And that for him just brings up too many recent memories of just what has happened. So him and his family have this idea that we need to go somewhere else because we're just too exposed to this. The chaos and transitions in Cambodia always leads to something worse. So they make the trek to Thailand, and it probably took them maybe 3 or 4 days. And within Thailand, there were mass and mass of people going there, hundreds of thousands, who had the same idea like my father. And you can imagine, these are people who had just gone through a genocide, so they're very weak and sick and starving, just carrying their life possessions on their backs. And very quickly, border camps started to form along the Thai-Cambodian border to accommodate for these now Cambodian refugees. And the hope was not to stay in Thailand like my father, but the hope was to find another country that would take them in overseas. The big dream was to go to America. And unfortunately, Thailand was very scared about what was taking place. They had seen that the wars had come through most of Southeast Asia. Communism had spilled through. And now one of their biggest enemies, the Vietnamese, were really on their border and their doorstep.
Yeah.
And they also felt that some of these refugees were surrogate communist radicals who were seeking to destabilize their country. So just very fearful about their stability of their country. They very much tried to create attention for this and asked the international community to help them. But because of the bureaucracy and because there was just not much focus on this, there just wasn't the help that they wanted at that point in time. So the Thai government decided, we're going to take this into our own hands. And so what they did is they took a lot of these refugees and sent them back to Cambodia, repatriated them back. Yet they did so in the most inhumane and horrific and just unimaginably cruel way one could conceive of.
Yeah.
Which is not to take them back to where they entered from the border, which is only a 6-hour drive, not even a 2-hour drive away, but they took them 8 hours overnight into the deepest part of the Thai-Cambodian border, up in the high mountains near the highest peak of Cambodia, and deposited them. They forced them out and kicked them down off of this mountainside, this 600-foot mountainside. And the geography was terrible. And this mountainside is known as Pravi here. And that area today has a temple next to it that is known as a UNESCO World Heritage Site, the second in Cambodia's designation that Cambodia's gotten after Angkor Wat.
Right.
But what they chose was to deposit them in this area because this geography was terribly covered with landmines. And so a lot of these refugees were forced to throw their possessions down and to rappel down these cliff sides. These are children and women and mothers and old people to flee the gunfire that's coming up from these Thai soldiers.
Yeah.
And then they're faced with this, with every step they take, they're very fearful what's what trail they're taking.
Sure.
And so it becomes, and this is the story of like the human crisis that takes place is who is going to save these refugees like my father who ends up there totally abandoned and totally there's no way of escape at all sides there.
It's just inconceivable that having gone so far, traveling for years essentially to escape the Khmer Rouge, being tormented all along the way, trying to work their way toward what they hoped was a friendly place, to be accepted at first, and then because the Thais realized how many people were fleeing Cambodia, they just panicked and said, we just can't have it, and made it as difficult as possible. Reading the descriptions of how everybody looked, I can't imagine that they would have looked at them and said, oh yeah, these are probably plants. You know, they're really communists that are coming in to take over our country. These are people that are starving to death. They're skin and bones, basically. And yet they dump them out in the jungle and say, that was horrific. Happily, that your dad was able to get out and some of his family, but he came from a big family, and the miracle is that any of them made it out.
One of the reasons I wanted to tell this story is because we forget that America had lost its war in Vietnam, yet they were still there on the Thai-Cambodian border trying to save refugees.
Yeah.
That makes no sense whatsoever as well.
Like, yeah.
Why?
Yeah. Why did
what losing nation does that?
Yeah. Why were the Americans showing up and going, okay, psst, we'll get you out of Thailand, we'll get you out of Cambodia, come with us. And they could have just as easily backed off and stayed away, but
they did not, yeah. That's a history that should be kind of giving tribute to this. In our own history.
There were losses along the way. It's obvious that your dad took care of his dad up until just about the last minute. And then it was, and your grandfather just held on as long as, longer than I think most people would be able to. And finally it was just enough was enough. That was really a difficult thing for your dad to leave his father behind, wasn't it?
It was probably one of the hardest things. He had the decisions he had to make. And my father has always had unreconciled feelings about the way he had to depart from his own father.
Yeah.
We were able to sort of bring some sort of reconciliation for that or some closure many years back where we took my father to the graveside of my grandfather. And he was able to pay his respects in that way. The story has, as I helped my father to tell this story, and there's this dynamic of, like, within this genocide and this escape from danger in this mountainside, there's this theme of, like, coming together as family.
Yeah.
And pulling together, and which I really didn't think much of, but when I took a step back, I was like, wow, you guys had nothing except one thing, which is each other.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I saw that clearly the love they had for each other is what helped them pull them through. And it's clearly the love my own father had for my grandfather, carrying him through at every step to get him through there.
Yeah.
And that was really evocative and for me, because I, in some ways, I was symbolically helping my father a generation later tell his story and carrying his burdens with him.
Yeah.
There.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, and the wonderful thing is there were happy endings, that your dad and a lot of his family that survived ended up in the United States together in Connecticut. When I read that, I just had to chuckle a little. I thought, you know, you could have brought them to the South where it's hot and muggy, and they might have felt more comfortable.
Yes.
There's an expat community of Vietnamese that escaped from South Vietnam in 1975 who live in a place called Bayou Le Batre on the Gulf Coast, and they fish in much the same way that they did back home. But in any case, the fact that your family was able to get to the United States and have a fresh start, I remember one of the things that really touched me is that your dad had heard about the Apollo 11 mission, the United States putting a man on the moon. And the Khmer Rouge said, oh, the Americans, they can't even grow their own food, you know, blah, blah, blah. They're not like us. And he thought, they put a man on the moon. maybe you're selling them short. And that's the way we felt too. You know, this is an amazing day for humanity, that what people have wanted to do for as long as they could see the moon in the sky. And there, and you can look up there and think, wow, there's footprints up there.
This book it talks about the power of hope, yeah. Really, and power of dreaming.
Yes.
And we start with that with Apollo. He gave a sense of hope to my father. He heard from his little country of Cambodia that America went to the moon. And it was an impossible thing that was done, a feat that was undertaken. And when he's going through this terrible ordeal, it's these thoughts of, like, I can believe in a greater hope. And because of that, he was able to overcome what he had gone through. Yeah. And that's sort of the triumphant message that I want to have every have, because it's inspirational.
I would love to meet your dad face-to-face someday and just tell him I'm so proud that he came to the United States and became a citizen here. These are the kind of people that we're delighted to have here. This is what made the country, is people like him who persevered and overcame and built a new life. I would be remiss if I did not mention the award-winning documentary Ghost Mountain that you were a part of, and that your dad, his story and that of his family inspired this documentary Ghost Mountain that came out in 2019 that you directed along with Virginia Dean. Can people still get copies of that? Is it online anywhere?
Yes, you guys, any of your viewers or listeners can find Ghost Mountain on PBS. The web link that we have is pbsghostmountain.com. It's a short doc of 40 minutes, and I think it's a very great companion to the book. It's great to watch the film first. It actually has my father's story and a few other survivors of an incident that happened at Pravir, but also a lot of the State Department workers and the NGOs who participated and were really impactful in saving these refugees and volunteering themselves. And they shed light on what happened as well from their side of the scene.
Yeah.
So please check that out. That's a that won the Happy Award Festival, and so for Best Doc Film. And it's been featured at, I think, 11 different film festivals.
Wonderful.
Across the country.
Wow.
So anyone across the U.S. Can see that, because it's through PBS.
That's awesome. Listen, I hope that lots of people pick up a copy of your book, and that a lot of people see this documentary, because there's a whole there are two generations that have grown up since all this took place. And if we don't tell them, we don't remind them that this could happen, then it will happen again. No, maybe not in Cambodia, but somewhere. Your father's story of hope and overcoming and family is an extraordinary story. And I hope lots of people hear us talking about it and get inspired to go get a copy of your book for themselves.
Thank you. We're so thrilled to be here and be able to share this really decade story that's been a long time in the making with your listeners. Thank you for that opportunity.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Our thanks again to James Tang, who told his father's story, May Bunsing Tang, under the Nagaj Tale, a true story of survival, bravery, and escape from the Cambodian genocide. It's from Greenleaf Book Group Press. You can go to gbgpress.com. And certainly, go to pbs.org and look for the award-winning documentary Ghost Mountain, which was released in 2019, that tells their story. We'll see you next time right here on your favorite podcast on thebookshelf.podbean.com, your favorite radio program on the bookshelf on WTBF AM 970 and FM 96.3, FM 94.7. We'll see you next time, and until then, God bless.